The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Georgine Rice. This week, a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
We had more than 4,300 rockets fired at us in Israel in 11 days.
We'll look behind the U.S. pressure on Israel to cease operations.
Right now, you have a timid White House that is running scared of the left.
We'll look at the Supreme Court's decision to take up an abortion case.
I think this is sort of sounding some bells for a lot of people on a potential overruling of Roe.
And a court victory for churches in California.
This particular historic development, it's permanent, it's statewide, it frees up all of the churches and places of worship in California.
All this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, your host. It's great to be with you again. I'm coming to you from Portland in my home station of KPDQ. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin in the Middle East, where on May the 21st, we saw a ceasefire in effect in the latest round of conflict between Israel and Hamas. Who won? Who lost? And what should we make of this latest violence? Joel Rosenberg is the author of some 20 books, both fiction and nonfiction. He's an evangelical from a Jewish heritage who is now living in Israel. Rosenberg was a guest of my colleague, Eric Metaxas.
How did this current conflict begin? Did Hamas indiscriminately shoot rockets into Israel?
Well, Hamas doesn't need a reason to start a war, but they, because in their charter from 1988, they call for the complete annihilation of the Jewish people and the state of Israel. So, okay.
Wait. Not just the state of Israel, but the Jewish people?
Well, certainly anybody that's in the land of Israel. And, you know, and so, okay, if you're a Jewish person outside of what they consider all of Palestine, you may be fine for a while until they achieve their initial objective, right? But they're ultimately trying to build an Islamic caliphate or kingdom where everybody, Christian, Jew, anybody else, has to bow down and worship the way they want. Otherwise, they'll kill you. They did use several reasons. First, they were looking for an opportunity to do the fundraiser and the political campaign. So they encourage young men to stockpile rocks and bricks and all kinds of things inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque on what we call the Temple Mount. And then on one of our high holy days, they ordered the young men to throw the rocks and the bricks down onto Jewish worshipers at the Western Wall, also known as the Wailing Wall. And this they knew would require Israeli police to come onto the Temple Mount and restore order. So that gave them television images of, the Jews are trying to take over the holy sites of Islam, come, man the barricades. And so this was the beginning. There was one other. There's been a real estate dispute in East Jerusalem, in a little community called Sheikh Jarrah. It's too complicated to get into in the time we have, but there have been about six families, Palestinian families, that have lived there for 70 years and have never paid rent. And there are new owners of those buildings that got sold, and they eventually, and the new owners said, listen, this is kind of ridiculous. You need to pay rent or you need to move. And after litigating it, the court said, yes, you have to pay rent. If you pay rent, you can stay. If you don't, you have to leave. They didn't. And Israel sent in the police to evict them as they would in New York City or L.A. or anywhere else. This was also an opportunity as a pretext for Hamas to say, see, the Jews are not only taking over the Temple Mount, they're trying to take over Jerusalem. They're terrible people, apartheid, colonialists, imperialists. And these were the triggers, on paper at least. We had more than 4,300 rockets fired at us in Israel in 11 days.
Okay, now when you say 4,300 rockets, these are the kind of rockets that could blow up a car. These are this is a big deal.
Blow up a car, take out the floor of a building. I mean, these are much more powerful than the rockets fired at us 7 years ago when the last big fight was.
Where did they fire the rockets? From where and to where?
Hamas and their partner in crime, Islamic Jihad, fired from civilian population centers in the Gaza Strip, from mosques, elementary schools, playgrounds, hospitals, businesses, factories. And they fired them at Israeli apartments, factories, synagogues, churches.
How many Israelis have been injured or killed?
I believe it was 13 Israelis were killed, and somewhere north of 700 were wounded.
You don't have to go back very far in our nation's history when support for Israel was bipartisan. Yes, some Democrat leaders still support the Jewish state, but there's a shift that's concerning. Michael Goodwin is a columnist for the New York Post. He joined Kevin McCullough on AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
What does the next year and a half to 3 years look like to you if the Democrats who know better in their own party don't put a stop to this foolishness?
Well, I think the question can't be answered without raising the big elephant in the room, which is Joe Biden. Is he really the president full time? Is he going to be the president? Or is this a kind of scrum for the ball that you see children playing soccer? They all chase the ball. Well, if the ball is the powers of the president, I think it's an open debate in the Democratic Party. Who's going to wield that power? And right now you have a timid White House that is running scared of the left. And last week when Rashida Tlaib lectured the president of the United States for 8 minutes on an airport tarmac, really ambushed him, was not planned, was not on his schedule. And he immediately starts to praise her, and the next day reverses his policy, tells Israel it must de-escalate and seek a ceasefire immediately. This is the kind of thing that if you're against Joe Biden, you say, wow, I can roll that guy. He's easy. And if you're on his side, you say, whoa, what kind of friend is he? So that's the dynamic, I think, that's at play.
Earlier this month, the Supreme Court agreed to hear an abortion case coming out of Mississippi. Pro-life advocates and activists hope that this will be the case to overturn Roe versus Wade. Could it be so? I turned to Sarah Parshall Perry of the Heritage Foundation.
The case is Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, and it's a challenge to the constitutionality of a Mississippi law that bars abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy in multiple circumstances with only two exceptions. So this comes after a year in which the court struck down a Louisiana law that required doctors who perform abortions to have the right to admit patients at a nearby hospital. That was last summer's Russo versus June Medical Services decision. And that was a 5-4 outcome requiring no admitting privileges whatsoever. And we now have, replacing Justice Ginsburg, a new justice in Amy Coney Barrett, who has remarked on her originalism and the fact that she interprets the Constitution using a textualist approach. And we also know personally in her own life, she is opposed to abortion, though that should not factor into the way that she decides one way or another. So we have a couple of complicating circumstances as concerns a review of this gestational age act. But regardless of where the justices come down, they'll naturally have to refer to Roe versus Wade as precedent at the high court.
Now, Mississippi raised three issues on appeal: whether abortion providers have third party standing to file lawsuits on behalf of their clients, their patients, if you will, challenging laws related to the rights of abortion, whether the validity of its law should be analyzed under the undue burden which the court addressed it some time in the past. Can you explain what Mississippi is asking the court to decide in this case and whether or not it's likely to have national implications, or it's going to be it's more likely that it will be narrowly decided and will only impact Mississippi?
So you're right in that they had actually raised request of review on three issues at the Supreme Court level, and the Supreme Court only took up one. And this is why I think this is sort of sounding some bells for a lot of people on a potential overruling of Roe. And that is the fact that they are determining whether limitations on abortions after 15 weeks are on their face constitutional. So in other words, can a state limit abortions after 15 weeks? We know in the past it was related to viability. That's usually 22 to 24 weeks. Mm-hmm. What the Supreme Court's saying is we are making one determination. Are these restrictions after 15 weeks constitutional or not? And it's the first time they've asked this question of viability since Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, and the first time they've taken into consideration gestational age since Roe versus Wade. So limiting it to strictly the question of constitutionality of these gestational age limits, I think, has a lot of people really thinking that they're going to do something drastic with Roe.
Now, you point out that some scholars believe that the Mississippi case is the perfect vehicle to overturn Roe versus Wade and its progeny, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Do you hold to that opinion? It is, of course, the first major abortion challenge heard by the court since the newest justice. What's your view on whether or not this is the perfect vehicle to revisit Roe v. Wade?
Well, some people have criticized the law itself, Mississippi's Gestational Age Act from 2018, as being sort of a Roe shopping vehicle. In other words, so limiting of abortion that it required the Supreme Court to finally take up the question of whether or not there was A, viability, and B, whether or not abortion restrictions were constitutional. So the fact that we've limited it to solely that question has, I think, a few people who are sort of advocates of reproductive choice up in arms. They have indicated, obviously, that they believe this was custom designed to raise this question. While it may have been, obviously, Mississippi passed a valid legislative law, signed into law by the governor. They followed appropriate process through the legislative avenue and democratic debate to be able to pass this law. Whether or not this is a vehicle designed to take up the question at the Supreme Court, we may never know. But I am hard-pressed to think of another case that might present such a factual and procedural alignment with previous cases as the one we're seeing come out of Mississippi. And the fact that we've seen a narrowing of the questions just to the one primary question is another reason a lot of people think, well, this is going to be the case to do it.
Coming up, a victory for churches in California.
This particular historic development, it's permanent, it's statewide, it frees up all of the churches and places of worship in California.
When the Christian Outlook returns, in a moment, stay with us.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Over the course of the pandemic, California has been one of the strictest states in its handling of houses of worship. Under the leadership of Gavin Newsom, the Golden State was quick to place restrictions on church meetings and slow to lift them. Well, a number of churches challenged the restrictions in court, with victories that were pretty well secured by a settlement that came from the Central District Court in California. Matt Staver of the Liberty Council joined Bill Bunkley at WTBN in Tampa.
I just got to say, congratulations, my brother. You got to be pretty excited about this one.
Yeah, we are very excited about it. We just give thanks to the Lord. This has been a real hard, long fight in California and in other places around the country. We're litigating all over the United States.
But, you know, when we started, we had naysayers. We had even people that are on our side saying this isn't winnable. We had, you know, people pontificating, professors from different law schools when they would comment to the media, this case is not winnable. But we lost in the district court, lost twice in the Court of Appeals, and won twice at the U.S. Supreme Court. Now we have the first ever statewide permanent injunction against these COVID restrictions. No more can California or Governor Gavin Newsom ever again, or anyone later, whoever might occupy the governor's seat or any public office in California, impose discriminatory restrictions on churches. So this particular historic development is a permanent injunction, means that it's out there forever. The court retains continuing jurisdiction, means that if there's ever a violation, whoever violates that on the state, they will face contempt of court. So this is permanent. It's statewide. It frees up all of the churches and places of worship in California. And California had to pay $1.35 million for a partial reimbursement of some of our attorney's fees and costs that we expended in this case.
That is sweet. Now, I'm not happy for the good citizens of California, and especially our brothers and sisters in Christ and other faiths, to be honest with you, that are going to benefit from this because it's taxpayer money. But you know what? You know what, Matt? You know this better than anything else. It's one thing to win, but when you start getting into a pocketbook, and at this level, even a government's pocketbook, guess what? There's going to be other jurisdictions that are keeping an eye not only how this case
exactly
went,
right,
and also is it going to cost them? Talk about that, because that's what's huge about this.
Well, that is big. Yeah. I mean, $1.35 million is something that sends a strong message. So they're not just getting away with this and walking away and say, good to know you. They have to pay. Here's the other thing, Bill. There's other cases that are pending in California. And so what does this do to them? That allows them, because we got the permanent injunction, they will fall like dominoes, and they too will have to be compensated by the state of California. So this $1.3 million is a lot more than that when you multiply it on these other cases, like a church, for example, that got fined over $3 million, $50,000 a pop for every time it met together, and you have a number of them like that. So this is going to be a big issue in California. But here's what we did. We are litigating in other cases right now, and we have now already filed that settlement from the court with the number of how much the state has to pay in all these other jurisdictions as well, because this is a shot over the bow. They should have caved a long time ago. They would not have to have any problem if they had just listened to our letters or even our lawsuits and litigation or briefs, but they didn't. And so they cannot just simply violate constitutional rights, close churches, discriminate against places of worship, and then just have no consequence. These people will have consequences, and particularly those elected leaders, especially the governors that ultimately made these terrible decisions. And here's the thing. We've wanted to, from the very beginning, not only win this case, but we've also had a goal to never go down this road again. And that's what this does in California. It means that we will never go down this road again. And that's our goal and all the states across the country.
This decision coming out of California is a win for religious liberty. But there's no question, the broader trends on religious liberty are not moving in a positive direction. From 2018 to earlier this year, Sam Brownback served as the United States Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, an office within our own State Department. He talked about the group's latest report on religious freedom with Don Crow, my colleague, on WAVA in the nation's capital.
What can you tell us about this latest report that was just released? What does it actually tell us? What does it actually do?
You know, it documents a number of things, but particularly things like China's war on faith that's real and persistent and deep and centralized. It's the Uyghurs, of course, getting kicked out in a genocide, but it's also the house church and underground Catholics. It tells us about the fighting that's going on in the Sahel and Nigeria, the number of Christians being killed there, and the congregating together of militant Islamic terrorist groups in that region in northern Nigeria and the countries surrounding it. It tells us about some bright spots, things going on positively in Central Asia, like Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, transitions in Sudan. But overall, it really speaks of a tough, tough situation for faith communities, minority faith communities around the world, and even genocide for religious minorities in a number of countries, like a place like what's happened in Burma to the Rohingya.
Now, on these reports, State Department submits them in accordance with the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998, as I recall. Those reports go what? Go to the Congress primarily and the president? And how important and useful have they proven to be?
They've proven to be really the gold standard around the world for what's taken place regarding religious persecution in various countries. I mean, this has been the most comprehensive report and the one that most people around the world base off of. You know, the tragedy is that you've got levels of Christian persecution that are highest that they've ever been in human history. You've got 80% of the world living in some sort of substantial religious restrictions. And then you have this new wave of persecution coming, the open-air prison that China's creating by virtue of cameras and artificial intelligence systems and DNA and tracking of cell phones and in the future, probably digitizing your currency so that every single transaction can be tracked. And if they don't like you because you're in a religious minority or some other group they don't favor, they can just shut it off. And you don't have any access to resources. So you know, these things are very concerning about what's taking place in the world today. And it's why we really need to stand up aggressively for this fundamental human right to do with your own soul what you see fit. That's what religious freedom is. And it's a part of human dignity, and it's a part of every one of our rights to have.
What can you tell us about any significant findings in this year's report compared to previous reports?
You know, I think really pointing out Nigeria and the significance of the problem there. Nigeria became a country of particular concern last year under Secretary Pompeo, and that's the first and only democracy that's in that group. I think that's really a new finding. The other thing that's really coming out in Africa is a lot of the battling in Africa is moving away from tribalism, but it's going to a Muslim-on-Christian fight and killings and very violent there. And then this new wave of using technology to oppress religious minorities to me is deeply concerning, because this technology, it doesn't have to be developed. It just has to be deployed. And you put it in authoritarian hands. This is very problematic. So we need to be aggressively pushing back against the misuse of technology.
Coming up, Christianity, both true and good.
I think that truth trumps goodness and beauty. I mean, if Christianity is true, regardless of what your feeling is about it, whether you like it, truth, you know, wins the day.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. Beloved, while I was making every effort to write to you about our common salvation, I felt the necessity to write to you, appealing to you to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all time handed down to the saints. Now, some of you may recognize those words from the book of Jude. Our next guest has found that the way we contend earnestly has changed in recent years. Kenneth Samples now serves with Reasons to Believe. He joined John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
I tackle both the truth question and whether Christianity is good. Like, has Christianity been good for racial minorities? What about slavery? What about some of these issues that relate to the goodness of Christianity?
Interesting. So does that mean, Ken, that because of the digital world in which we live, it seems like fewer and fewer people can actually believe something is really true? So that's not what they're after in this question?
I think so. I, from a philosopher's point of view, I think we've moved from modernism, which was preoccupied with whether something is true, whether it's real. And I think we've kind of adopted a postmodern point of view that says, well, nobody can really know whether it's true, so let's ask whether it's good or if it's good for us.
So then does that mean, Ken, as whether it's your pastor at your local corner church,
you have to talk about truth first and foremost, because we've lived in a post-truth world. I mean, how do you go back continually to the truth of the gospel, to the truth of Christianity, and the goodness that it's derived, that what we as the world, as society, has derived since man has walked the earth?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is I would define two types of atheists. There's one atheist who says, you know, may not be a bad thing if God existed. Maybe I'd survive the death of my body. Maybe I'd be reunited with my loved ones after death. Problem is, Christianity is not reasonable. It's not a rational option. Mm. Then there's another type of atheist who says, no, I actually think there is a rational basis for Christianity. Got some pretty smart people who are Christians, but I don't want that God to exist. I don't want that God intervening on my life. And I thought, wow, maybe we need to do both. We need to keep arguing for the reasonableness of Christianity, but maybe we need to remind people that Christianity actually has been good for the world, and maybe look at those areas in which people have objections.
Then let's go back to talk about truth, you know, in this world, this rational world, right? Because say we lived in a world pre-science, people tended to believe the truth of the gospel. They tended to believe in the truth of God. And then science came in, in a stillborn way, I guess. I think I've heard you describe it as that. Science came in a stillborn way, but then in the world that God made, you know, through mathematics and logic and, you know, the revival of the beginning of 17th century science, those two things, truth and science, came together and lifted up the truth of God even deeper. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And I think you make a great point that I completely agree with, that if we look at truth, goodness, and beauty, kind of these transcendentals that Christians would talk about, I think that truth trumps goodness and beauty. I mean, if Christianity is true, regardless of what your feeling is about it, whether you like it, truth, wins the day. But you see, now we live in a culture where people are very doubtful whether anybody can know truth. So they're asking, I think, more questions about its goodness. And in my book, I'm arguing maybe we need to do both and meet people and say, well, not only do I think Christianity is true, I think it's really been a good thing.
So, Ken, when people say, is Christianity good, what do you say?
I think Christianity has been very good for the world. For example, slavery was brought to an end in the Western world, largely because people said, you know what, everybody is made in the image of God. They have dignity and value because regardless of their skin color, regardless of their sex, their class, their health, their age, I think slavery was a great evil, but the vast majority of the abolitionists in the West were Christian. And so, there are some dark periods of Christian history. I think overall, Christianity has been a great source to help human beings flourish.
So then in this doubter age we live in, Ken, how do you communicate that? I mean, how do you make the gospel appealing for people who don't even want to engage in that conversation?
I think in Christian civilization, so let's think about the ancient world, the medieval world, Christians would talk through the prism of truth, goodness, and beauty. I think that that's been flipped. And I think today we have a preoccupation with race, gender, and class.
Coming up, cake makers and the First Amendment.
Free speech shouldn't be just for those who agree with the government. It should apply to both sides. It should go both ways.
When the Christian Outlook returns, in a moment, stay with us.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
If I knew you were coming, I'd bake a cake, bake a cake, bake a cake.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Jack Phillips is a name that many of you are at least somewhat familiar with.
He's an unlikely character to have had any sort of national recognition. He's a humble cake shop owner outside of Denver who was asked to do something that, as a man of conviction, he just couldn't do. He's now written a book sharing his story, The Cost of My Faith, How a Decision in My Cake Shop Took Me to the Supreme Court. Jack was a guest on my program, along with Jonathan Scruggs, one of the attorneys with Alliance Defending Freedom. Why not just bake the cake? I mean, it's sugar, it's flour. Why not bake the cake? What's the difference?
Well, it's more than just sugar and flour and eggs. It's like I said, it's my canvas. It's what I create art on. In this case, the wedding cake itself, a wedding cake by itself, has an inherent message. If you were at a hotel room and you walked in, opened the door to a conference room and looked in the corner and there's a cake sitting on the table, you would know that that was a wedding was to be celebrated there. You wouldn't think it's a business meeting. You would know instinctively just by seeing that wedding cake that there's a wedding taking place. So the wedding cake itself has an inherent message. And this was a message to celebrate a view of marriage that goes against my biblical view, my biblical belief of marriage and what the Bible teaches. And so it was a message that I couldn't create. And so I tried in those few sentences to tell these men, I'll serve you anything else. You know, you're welcome. I'll make other custom cakes. But I can't create cakes that express messages that go against my faith.
Now, Jonathan, you're an attorney. Talk a little bit about the legal ramifications of making the announcement that I have declined to create a certain kind of cake that that contradicts my biblical worldview.
When he declined to create that cake, he was essentially sued by the government. It was put through an administrative process through the state and accused of violating Colorado's public accommodation law, which bans discrimination. And that's essentially what the state accused him of doing. And our defense was simple, that Jack serves everyone. He just doesn't convey all messages that are requested of him. This is no different than an LGBT artist who declines to create artwork condemning same-sex marriage, right? No one, the government shouldn't force that. It shouldn't force Jack either. So that case proceeded up through the system and eventually went to the U.S. Supreme Court, where the U.S. Supreme Court said that Colorado officials treated Jack unfairly, that they showed hostility toward his religious beliefs, both in what they said and also in how they treated him unfairly compared to other bakers and other artists. And we won. So Jack can fill in a little bit about those details. But the overall ruling of the case is, you know, the government shouldn't force people to speak messages they disagree with that violates their core convictions. And that's a freedom that should apply to both sides and on all different views.
Well, it seems like the Supreme Court decision should put an end to the argument. Is that the end or is this an ongoing debate?
Unfortunately, it's an ongoing debate. You would think that a U.S. Supreme Court decision would settle it, but you have seen governments, even in Jack's situation, but also across the country, try to apply these similar laws to force other artists to speak messages they disagree with. But you also see courts squarely ruling in the favor of these artists, such as there's a court in Arizona, a court in Minnesota that ruled in favor of these decisions. And, of course, Jack is being sued again most recently. He just recently went through a trial because he was basically someone requested him to create a cake celebrating a gender transition, which Jack declined. So we're seeing these incidents pop up all across the country. We're continuing to defend them. We're continuing to defend Jack because the First Amendment and free speech are on his side.
Making the decision to decline making a cake for a same-sex wedding ceremony has been very costly. In fact, you could not have anticipated how costly it would have ultimately be. Let me ask you if you've ever second-guessed that decision and what the cost has been for you, for your business, and for your family.
You know, honestly, we have never second-guessed it. Before we started the cake shop, we knew what those lines would be that we couldn't cross, and this was one of them. We couldn't cross it then, we couldn't cross it now, and I've never once thought, well, maybe I should have just made the cake. The decision that we made was right, but it has been a costly decision. We had 10 employees before this all happened. We were down to 4, including myself. We lost our very lucrative wedding business, which was a large percentage of our income, and it was, yeah, some hard ramifications from that, but the decision was easy and the decision was right.
I know a lot of believers in particular who just want to stay out of the spotlight. If we just don't say anything, if we just keep our heads down, we can avoid the kind of challenge that you have obviously had to live with. Where did the courage come from to make that initial pronouncement and then to stay the course that ultimately led you to the U.S. Supreme Court?
God was gracious in that, in giving us the practice in saying this is not a cake that we can create because of our religious beliefs, our deeply held religious convictions. And so we were prepared when the big one came. And then standing up for it, you know, the options were you either stand up for it or you fold or you close the shop or the state finds you or whatever and you lose the shop. And all of those were costs we were willing to take. But we couldn't go back and change the decision, and we wouldn't.
How has God used this situation to generate conversation or to give you opportunities to share your faith? Has there been that side of this whole conflict as well?
Oh, there has been. Right from the first, like the very first Saturday, the two men came in on Thursday, and then on that following Saturday, I was getting all these crazy, hateful, weird phone calls. But then I got a call in the middle of the day from a man who identified himself as an atheist from somewhere up northwest United States, and we had a conversation. It was like 45 minutes long, and I gave him the gospel, you know, three or four different ways. Or another day, a radio station, a local station, did a broadcast from our show, a live broadcast from our shop. And one of the first men that came in at 5 o'clock that morning identified himself, said, "My name is Mike Jones, and I'm a gay man, and I came to see what's going on here. Hi, Mike, how are you?" And we struck up a conversation, and he came back later that day, and we've become friends ever since. And what makes that unique is that Mike Jones was a former gay activist, and he's on our side now, and he even testified for us in the last court case back in March. And it's just amazing the platform that God has given us.
Are we close to a time in which the question of whether or not an artist, for example, is free to decline to produce art that does not comport with their deeply and sincerely held beliefs?
Free speech shouldn't be just for those who agree with the government. It should apply to both sides. It should go both ways. And that's a winning message, both in the courtroom, but also more broadly. I think people understand that we can't have these freedoms be selective.
Coming up, the CBS program, 60 Minutes.
They didn't even counsel me. I had three appointments.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
In this week's edition of Meeting of Minds with Jerry Boyer, I talk with Christian philosopher Oz Guinness about what he saw when he came to America 50 years ago and what he's seen since.
I came here in 68. 100 American cities were ablaze. Martin Luther King, of course, assassinated in April, and then Bobby Kennedy in July. But the radicals realized, and here's the significance, that they wouldn't win in the streets. So they called for Herbert Marcuse and Rudy Deutschke and others for a long march through the institutions. In other words, win the high schools and the colleges and universities, win the press and the media, win Hollywood and entertainment, and then you've won the cultural gatekeepers and you can win the whole thing. And clearly, 50-odd years later, they've done it.
To listen to the whole thing, go to meetingofmindspodcast.com. That's meetingofmindspodcast.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. If you've tracked with the Christian Outlook in recent years, you know that we've done extensive coverage of transgender issues, including the threat to women's sports. We've also looked at the hasty way medical professionals facilitate something so radical as the effort to change one's gender. But we've seen very little coverage from the elite media questioning the wisdom of gender transition or taking seriously the damage done to young men and women. The CBS program 60 Minutes surprised Bob Burney, my colleague on WRFD, The Word, in Columbus, Ohio.
Is it possible there is the beginning of an awakening here? On 60 Minutes, they ran a segment on transgender issues. Okay, that doesn't surprise me at all. But what shocks me is that a major portion of the 60 Minutes segment on transgenderism featured transgender individuals who realized, I made a terrible mistake. Yeah, they featured individuals who went through the transition or began the transition from one gender to another and realize I have made a horrible mistake, and they decided to reverse. Now, this is what's happened in Great Britain with this huge lawsuit. A young woman took the Tavistock Clinic in Great Britain, the largest transgender clinic in Great Britain, took them to court because they transitioned her. And what she said was, I was too young to give consent. I didn't know what I was doing. I was confused about my gender. I went to get help. I didn't get help. I got surgery. And she won. And there is an awakening in Great Britain because of the scientific testimony in that trial. Same thing is happening in Sweden. Same thing is happening in Finland. It has not happened in America yet. And as I said before the break, even the president of the United States is a proponent of something with no scientific foundation whatsoever, transgenderism. He said on several occasions to transgender people, I got your back. Last night, 60 Minutes ran an explosive segment interviewing young people who went through the transition and realized it was a terrible mistake and de-transitioned. They were at different stages of transitioning, hormones, surgery, and so forth. And 60 Minutes interviewed several of these young people who said, they didn't even counsel me. I had 3 appointments. And I said, I'm a boy. I think I want to be a girl. Okay. Well, let's give you some hormones. Leslie Stahl, who did the interview, was shocked.
Well, that wraps up this edition of The Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Mike Cook, Alex Perez, and James Blind, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook.